welcome to Monday. It's great to have you here. Can I just tell you something? If you plan to turn the channel, that's all great. I get it. Just do this one thing for me. Promise me one thing. You will never, ever, ever act as your own lawyer. Just promise me that. I am going to give you the reason why. I am going to show you the reason why. But even if you think you are so smart and you watched LA Law way back in the day and Suits these days, promise me you won't do it. Because you'll end up on my show, as Lori Vallow is tonight. This is Lori. She has decided in a murder trial to represent herself. P.S. It's her fourth murder, right? This is the trial for the fourth murder that she's been accused of, guilty of three others. It is just a joke. Like, it's embarrassing to see how often the judge has to say, ma'am, let me explain something. And how often this poor jury has to sit through like cringeworthy moments, like her opening statement. I'm going to do like the whole summary for you in a bit. You got to see this. We also have eyes in the courtroom, so you're going to get the insider's impression of what it was like to actually sit through it all in that courtroom. Also, I have a thing. Whenever I cover a trial, I obviously want to see what the evidence is. I want to see what comes up on the big screen. I want to see the lawyers in action. But what I really, really want to see is the defendant and what the defendant does during all that evidence. There is an undocumented immigrant in a courtroom in Maryland right now, accused of murdering that mother of five. And I'm telling you, the evidence is as grisly as it gets. And trust me, I've seen a few of these things. This is bad. The visuals, the photographs, the horrors that this whole courtroom is having to sit through. God bless this jury. It is horrendous. But his reaction? That's something you're going to have to wait to hear about. Quite something. And then on one hand, you've got a YouTuber, and on another hand, you've got a remote tribe that's literally like never had any contact with people in the outside world. What would happen if they came together? What do you think? Well, for starters, when people have tried it before, they've been murdered and their bodies have never been collected. But this fella figured he could do it. And he decided to bring a Diet Coke. There is so much more to this story. Stick around and find out why he is now in prison. And lucky that he's in prison. That's all coming up in just a moment. Let me start here, though. Lori Vallow Daybell has done a lot of objectionable things in her life. For one, she murdered two of her kids. For two, she murdered the wife of the guy that she wanted to marry, and then she did marry him just weeks later. For three, she may have murdered her fourth husband to make way for that last marriage. And trust me, there are so many other things, which I will get to in a moment. But that fourth husband, Charles Vallow, that is why she is currently in an Arizona courtroom, charged with his murder. For the rest of us, and I am assuming that you're with me on this one, being on trial for murder would be the worst thing in our entire world. But for Lori, it's kind of like a big field trip. It's like a fresh break from her very boring life sentence, no parole in Idaho. She also has a chance to show off to the world that she knows a thing or two about the law. You know, like having been tried for three murders before, being tried for this fourth one. And today things kicked off in earnest in Arizona. The prosecutor, as is normal, spoke for the people, and Lori Vallow spoke for Lori Vallow as her own attorney. And if that's a big surprise, it should be, because this is the same woman who was not even competent to stand trial months ago, let alone defend herself. But here we are with Lori Vallow parading around the courtroom, making blunder after blunder right out of the gate. If you did not have time to catch her entire performance, I've got your back. Here is her attempt at an opening statement. And please keep in mind, trials can be won or lost during opening statements. So you have to tell the best story you can put together for the jury. But in what could be considered a drinking game, count the number of times that Lori says the words, "The evidence will show."
The evidence will show that on the morning of July 11th, that Tylee was asleep in her room and my brother Alex was asleep in the guest room. The evidence will show that when Charles entered the house, only JJ and I were awake and present. The evidence will show that after we put JJ in the rental car, that Charles came back into the residence to receive his phone, leaving JJ in the front seat of the rental car with the engine running. He was 7 years old. The evidence will show that Charles began to scream at me when I refused to hand him his phone. The evidence will show that Charles' screaming woke up Tylee and Alex. The evidence will show that Tylee came out of her room with a bat to protect me, her mother, from her stepfather, Charles Belt. The evidence will show that Tylee and Charles fought over the bat, and that after a struggle over the bat, Tylee fell onto the ground, and Charles lifted up the bat to hit Tylee with the bat. The evidence will show that Alex then intervened to protect Tylee from being hit with the bat. The evidence will show that after this struggle on the ground between Charles and Alex, that Charles prevailed with the bat and began to come towards me with the bat as I ran away from him into the kitchen. The evidence will show that at some point while I was running away from Charles, who was chasing me with the bat, that Alex apparently retrieved his gun. The evidence will show that Tylee and I got into the rental car with JJ and drove away. The evidence will show you that I drove the children away from the residence towards JJ's school.
Can I grab a tissue?
Yes.
The evidence will show that the last thing I heard from Chandler Police Department until June of 2021, 2 years later, when I received a grand jury indictment from them for this alleged crime. The evidence will show that Chandler Police treated this incident as self-defense.
And object to that?
Objection sustained. The jury should disregard that last statement.
Yeah, that was not the only objection that Lori faced in court today. By the way, there's no crying in lawyering. You're not allowed to cry if you're going to be your own lawyer. You got to be a lawyer or you can be the defendant crying, but you can't do that. She did it anyway. So in her like cross-examinations, Lori really seemed to struggle. She had a real blind spot when it came to the rules of hearsay, which is literally things that other people say that are overheard, right? These are things that are generally not allowed in a courtroom. There are exceptions, but it's tricky. Any first-year law student would know that. And the prosecutor and the judge both seemed exhausted that Lori did not.
When you talked to the two detectives in the front yard and gave them your synopsis of what had happened, you said they got into a domestic fight consistent...
Objection.
I'm sorry.
I'm going to sustain the objection.
What was the legal objection?
Hearsay.
Hearsay.
Oh, I was just reading his report. Okay.
An objection, no question.
Please ask your next question.
You said in your report that at one point Alex's niece grabbed the bat.
Objection.
Hold on.
Hearsay.
That's
improper
hearsay.
Question.
Okay, you can't ask hearsay.
Did Alex tell you that he got hit in the head with the bat?
Objection, Your Honor. Hearsay, prior ruling.
Yeah, it's sustained. You can't ask questions of what Alex said.
But they were trying to come up to me to find out what was happening.
Objection, okay. Speculation, hearsay.
I'll sustain the objection. Let's take our afternoon break for the staff and the jurors. We're going to take a 15-minute stretch restroom break. Please remember the admonition.
Lawyering is hard. It's really hard. It is not what it looks like on TV. This is where I stop and I bring in Lindsay Holler. She is the producer of my podcast, Drop Dead Serious. She is live on location. She's been in that courtroom all day today. Lindsay, look, we just showed some highlights / lowlights, but overall, you got the full picture of Lori's performance. How would you grade it? How'd she do?
Well, you know, she did seem like she did a little bit of homework, but the problem is that, you know, she's the defendant, and part of her, and she's also her own lawyer, so she's trying to tell her own story, but the problem is that Lori's story doesn't compute with the evidence that's going to come out. And so, you know, as much as she wanted to appear composed and calm, you could see she was getting visibly frustrated, and especially when she would get objected to. You know, why? It's, you can't ask that.
Right, so that's the thing I wanted to say, because a lot of times the camera position is like this. We can either see the side of her face or the back of her head, but during those objections, I saw none of her face at all. I'm not sure if you had a position where you could see, but what was her, like, did she look as though she recognized she'd made a mistake, or did she honestly just not understand what was going on in that courtroom?
I think both. There were times where she seemed like she understood, oh, I'm sorry, you know, little mistake, but then other times where I think she legitimately didn't know what she was doing, and you could tell. And I did have a close seat. I could see everything, and I mean, especially during opening statements when the prosecutor was saying things she obviously didn't like. She was angry. She looked furious.
Well, you know, I'd seen the report that she was rolling her eyes and shaking her head. So walk me through that a little bit. Give me your eagle eye perspective, because again, we get the back of her
head. So she was, I actually was kind of on the right side of her, so I could see, you know, she would shake her head and kind of, you know, look down, scribble furiously onto her legal pad. At one point, when the prosecutor said that the jury was going to hear that she was crushing up JJ's pills to drug Charles, she flipped her legal pad, her yellow legal pad, over and slammed it. And I'm not sure if the court audio picked that up, but it was really loud in court. And, you know, if the jury sees that, they see her demeanor, they're going to start wondering, what's going on? Why is she making faces during the prosecutor's opening statement?
Not only that,
it was remarkable.
If you're a lawyer doing that, you would be held in contempt of court. You might get a warning, maybe a second warning, but you'd be held in contempt of court. At any point did the judge take her aside? At any point did the judge say something publicly like, Ms. Vallaudebel, you're going to have to stop that behavior? And I can't imagine he would say that to her in the presence of the jury, but at any point did anyone counsel her, grow up?
No, they didn't. And I'm wondering, we're going to get to a point where he's going to have to do that, because this is just opening statements. You know, you could tell she was trying to appear calm, trying to be on her best behavior, but she just couldn't let herself do that. She couldn't control herself. I mean,
she also
like
doesn't
always,
understand.
Like she always is.
That's not what lawyers do. Yeah, like she always is. I could see with her interview with Keith Morrison how histrionic she was, repeating his name over and over.
Yes,
one last quick question.
Yeah.
Those are the same ones that you got in the Keith interview. Okay, one last really quick question. We lost a juror today. Is it a big deal, a serious deal? Can you just sum it up in like 20 seconds? What happened with the juror?
Yeah, so the juror's employer actually sent in a note to the judge that, you know, the employer had a problem with him having jury service. The judge questioned the juror a little bit about this at the lunch break, and the juror basically said that he didn't know much about jury duty, and when he agreed, he didn't know that, you know, he wouldn't get paid, and he had child support and alimony, and this would really be a financial hardship on him. So ultimately, he was dismissed. The prosecution seemed a little bit more worried about it than Lori, obviously, because she's not worried about much. But I think they were frustrated to lose a juror on day one, for sure.
Oh, I mean, losing a juror on day one, that is really, I don't think I've ever seen that happen. But it does happen. I get it. Lindsay, thank you so much. I really appreciate all the notes from court today. Really, really good to have you in there with the eyes and ears. And we'll talk to you again soon. Thanks for this.
Thanks, Ash.
Okay, I am joined now by Megan Connor. Megan is Lori Vallow's cousin and was also in the courtroom today, and she happens to host the podcast called The Midlife Revolution. Megan, thank you so much for being with me. First, when I heard that you were in court, I had to do a mental calculation, because I have heard that there is not one member of Lori Vallow's family or any supporters there for her. And then when I heard you were there, I still sort of thought she doesn't have any supporters. Am I right? You're not there for her. You're there as a witness.
No, I mean, if I can quote Hamilton, I'm not here for you. Definitely not there to support Lori. I'm there to learn the truth of what happened. And I'm there to get some, you know, some measure of closure in my own, all the questions that I have in my mind of what happened in the days leading up to Charles's death and afterwards, how the Cox family behaved and who was involved and at what level.
Yeah, I can understand that. And my choice of words was wrong when I said a witness. I meant you wanted to see what was happening. You're not actually a witness going to, right, you know, take the stand in the case. But I wanted to ask you if the Lori that you saw today, because listen, you're a family member. We are really just seeing her speaking for the first time. She was silent during her trial. We saw her sit there, really, and she didn't take the stand. So this is very eye-opening to see this personality popping out. Is this the same Lori that you know, that you and your family grew up with, or is this someone you don't recognize?
Well, there's definitely an aspect to Lori that has changed over the last years. Her histrionic style, her religious zealotry, her delusion, those are things that have changed. But the tactics that she uses to try and get her way, to try and manipulate, to try and get what she wants, those are the same things that I personally have seen historically. And I know not all my family members agree with me about that, but my personal experiences with Lori, very much the same. You know, her fake crying today, I believe it was fake. And her basically trying to endear herself to witnesses and to jurors by sort of making jokes, pretending to laugh along. You know, she was really trying hard to get people on her side. And that's kind of the Lori I've always seen. However, in a courtroom setting, she has rules and she can't use the same tactics that have worked for her before. And I think that's really frustrating to her.
I can imagine. And you know what? The rules are tricky. Even for people who know the law, it's very hard to navigate criminal procedure in that courtroom. And I'm about to ask someone who's an expert in this exactly how tricky it is and why, even when you know what you're doing, you don't know what you're doing. But I do need to ask you this. The rest of your family, how do they feel about you being there? And how do they feel about what's happening in this courtroom?
Well, I do want to point out that my uncle Rex was there today. This is Lori's uncle also, and he was there with three of his daughters. They came to some of Lori's previous trial. I think it's important to them to see some of the evidence in this case. They've all lived close to each other for a long time. I will just say I have a different perspective from a lot of my family members because I've distanced myself from this particular part of the family, the Cox part of the family, for a long time. And I also am no longer a part of the LDS Church. And so my perspective from the outside is very different than the perspective of a lot of my family members. I've also been through a great deal of therapy and healing. And so I have a hair trigger for manipulation and control. I recognize those tactics like right off the bat. And for other family members, it's a little bit harder for them to accept that this is the way that Lori has always been.
Megan, I'm really appreciative of you being on the show and being so candid. And I'm very sorry that you and your family are going through this as well. This can't be easy for any of you. So I hope I can speak with you again as this progresses.
Of course. I'm always happy to come on your show. I enjoy your show and I enjoy your podcast. So I'm happy to do it.
Oh, I appreciate that. You know what? For that, I'm going to just do the quick plug again. Megan Connor's podcast is called The Midlife Revolution. Thank you, Megan. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Ashley.
I want to turn now to a defense attorney who, unlike Lori, actually has a law degree and thousands of hours of practice. It's Mark Iglar, friend of the show, friend of mine. It's not easy, is it? It's not like it looks like on Suits. It's not like it looks like on LA Law. Criminal procedure on your feet in a courtroom litigating is hard.
Yes. So let's start with something I agree with you. It is difficult and it should be left for those who went to law school. That said, Ashley, I don't come on your show to disagree with you. I just find myself doing so every now and then. First, yes, she should have had her own lawyer. Secondly, she did a horrible job on cross-examination. Third, if she said the evidence will show one more time, I was going to wring her neck metaphorically. That said, I'm giving her a B as in boy minus on her opening statement. She was passionate. And by the way, I'm no fan of the murderer. She was connecting with what she was saying. She took her time. When she was describing the important details of what occurred, you almost felt like you were there, that this looked like self-defense. Obviously, it's all hogwash, but all it takes is one juror to believe in what she's saying. And every time the prosecution objects, every time the judge shuts her down, they could feel for her, like she's doing the best she can, and these smarty-pants lawyers are shutting her down.
You know, let me ask you this, Mark, because we've talked about the blunders, we've talked about the complete, you know, inability to understand hearsay. This is going to keep happening, and it's going to be very frustrating for these jurors that the judge is going to have to continue schooling her like this. And eventually, the judge may not want to school her anymore. I am more concerned, though, with if and when her triple murder conviction comes into the case. People hear about prior bad acts all the time. They're not always allowed in. Those are going to make their way in. Just, it's a question of how and when.
Yeah, well, if it does, I don't know that the judge ruled that that's admissible. Is that your understanding? Because if so, that would grossly prejudice this jury. They hear that, they're done. If that does come into this case, which I don't believe it should because it's so more prejudicial than probative. And again, you wanted to get a fair trial. You don't want to do this twice. I don't think it should come in. If it does, she is done.
Well, I think it's going to come in because I think she is going to take the stand because she is literally on the stand almost in, you know, demonstrative ways in this courtroom. But let's have this conversation again because this is something I just don't know how or when it's going to happen. But she's so terrible at understanding criminal procedure, she's going to open a door. I believe she will inadvertently open a door because even great lawyers open a door by mistake and then all that stuff floods in. Will you come back when that, if that happens, when that happens?
I will. And on that last point, I do agree with you.
Oh, my gosh. Can we just make sure that's on tape? This is on tape, right? Mark Aglarsh just agreed with me. I've waited my whole career for that. Thank you, Mark. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
He will be back. All right. Before we go to break, I just want to update you on the Karen Reed trial in Massachusetts. You'll know this. It's a retrial. But her lawyer says this whole thing is unconstitutional, this retrial. And so with jury selection well underway, we're 10 jurors picked so far. Her team is asking the United States Supreme Court to step in and stop this, shut the whole thing down on the grounds that this retrial is double jeopardy since the jury last time actually agreed on the top count. They just didn't write it down. I'm going to keep you posted on that. And still to come in the show, murder trials are never easy for the people in the courtroom. The families of the victims struggle to get through the graphic pictures, and the jurors are often floored by the stuff they have to look at. But in those moments, I always look at the defendant. How does that defendant react to the blood and the gore? And the undocumented immigrant who was accused of killing a Maryland mom of five, he had quite the curious reaction to the bloodbath on full display in his case. Full update next.
Thanks for listening to News Nation On The Go. I'm Leland Vittert. This is America's fastest growing cable news network, delivering fact-based, unbiased news from all sides.
It is not a crime if you don't show emotion in court. It is certainly not proof of murder. But if that's the crime you're charged with, and extremely graphic photos of your alleged victim are on display for everyone to see, being stone-faced may not help your case. Of course, Victor Martinez Hernandez could have cried his eyeballs out today, and it wouldn't change the real evidence, mostly DNA, that ties him to the grotesque rape and murder of Rachel Morin in Maryland. On Friday, the volunteer who found her in a drainage tunnel on the Ma and Pa Trail testified that there was so much blood, he thought he was looking at a deer carcass. Today, jurors heard from the 911 caller, that was a fellow searcher. She was sobbing and gasping for air, telling dispatchers that she almost threw up and passed out. And then came the crime scene photos. The jury sat frozen. The victim's family was in tears. Her distraught mother was being consoled by a victim's advocate. And the defendant, a 23-year-old undocumented immigrant from El Salvador named Victor Martinez Hernandez, he
was entirely unmoved. Our national correspondent, Caitlin Becker, was in the Harford County Courthouse. She is live with me now outside of that courthouse. No reaction at all. I mean, this was some of the worst kind of evidence that anyone in a courtroom, lawyers and judges included, have ever seen. Nothing from him?
Ashley, the photos were so brutal. They were humiliating for poor Rachel Morin, for this victim, her naked body, all of the damage that was done to her skull really put on display. It was really, really hard to see. And he sat there and was very active and intent in listening. He looked up at every single one of those photos that were put on the screen, and he actually got a chance to look at them twice because physical copies of them are handed to the defense team before they're entered into evidence by the court. So he was able to glance at them, both the physical copies and on that screen, and really no reaction. I could see the side of his face very, very clearly. The only thing he did do was intensely write notes. He would look at the photos, look at the screen, scribble some notes. Look at the photos, look at the screen, scribble some notes, despite the fact that there was family crying. They weren't audibly crying, so I don't think he saw that. And the jurors, as you said, sat frozen. It was incredibly graphic and incredibly heartbreaking, Ashley.
What about the jury and their reaction? I mean, I can imagine how awful this was for her family. You don't need to tell me that again, but what about the jurors? How did they react while he was stone-faced?
You know, they did a pretty good job of not reacting. You see, you know, they're instructed really not to overdo it or try not to visibly react. But there was shifting in seats. There was discomfort. Things got a little tedious at times during the testimony, and I could see people sort of yawning and nodding off, but not when these graphic photos were put on the screen. Every single juror in that jury box, including the alternates, sat there, and they forced themselves to look at the graphic, heartbreaking, brutal nature of these photos. And Ashley, I can't overstate, of course, we know how brutal, of course, this is by hearing that she was bashed in the head and bludgeoned and strangled. But for me, it was the fact that she was tossed nude in this tunnel that it was almost the worst part. And the jurors tried, I could see them kind of glancing away when those more graphic photos of her naked body were up there, but they really did try to sit as stoically as possible, take their own notes. But the prosecutors did a really good job of not having those photos linger up there very long. They established what they were there to do, and she switched them out pretty quickly to just save her some dignity.
Well, that's it. You know, thank you for mentioning that, because that is not often mentioned, is the humiliation and the dignity to that victim. Because that is a person, that is a daughter, that is a mom up there. And just imagine if it were you. It's so awful to think that she is being victimized again by being humiliated like that in the courtroom with those. But it's essential to justice, so I understand it. Let me ask you something about the undocumented immigrant sitting at defense table. Does he speak English? Does he have a translator? Does he have anybody from the consulate in El Salvador sitting with him? Like, what's and any family, anybody supporting him in the gallery?
There did appear to be two women in the gallery today that may have been family members. They were seated closest to the defense table and the furthest from Rachel Morin's family and supporters, and they were clearly not media. So they did appear to be there for him, but he never looked in the gallery and never, ever acknowledged them. He is equipped with translations. There are two translators. They are taking turns. They switch off every couple of minutes, actively translating in real time, not only the testimony, but they also go up there and follow the attorneys up there when they do sidebars. He goes up as well. So he is involved in every step of the way and very clearly seems to understand what's going on. I mean, I can't explain really how much he's writing. I mean, probably 15, 20, 30 pages out of a yellow legal pad and not random notes. I couldn't see what he was writing, but I could see clearly that he was fully filling up every single line left to right, no space left, and then flipping to the next page and then continuing to write notes.
Well, it will be interesting one time if we ever get to figure it out what it is he's writing and to whom. Thank you for doing this. It's also very hard for you, Caitlin, I understand, to be in a courtroom like that. I don't care if you do this job forever. None of that stuff is easy to process. So thank you for doing the job for us. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Ashley.
All right. That's Caitlin doing that for us. God bless her. And coming up, a woman who shared the spotlight with Diddy in good times and bad. And when I say bad, I mean horrible. She was the unwilling star of this video, allegedly showing Diddy in a rage, beating her, kicking her, and dragging her by the hair. But now victim number one is about to do something most accusers have not done and don't do. And it could start a wave against P. Diddy just a month out from his trial. We've got the details next.
You're listening to Banfield on News Nation's audio stream, available 24/7 on the News Nation app, or just say, Alexa, play News Nation.
We are all allowed to face our accusers in court. It is a fundamental right guaranteed in the Constitution. But sex crime accusers don't have to be identified publicly. In the federal indictment accusing Sean Diddy Combs of sex trafficking, among other things, the accusers are identified simply as victims 1 through 4. But now victim number 1 plans to testify under her real name. And it is a name that's been associated with Diddy for a long time. Cassie Ventura. It was Cassie Ventura who filed the civil suit that opened the legal floodgates. And it was Cassie Ventura who was seen in that horrible surveillance video being kicked and punched and dragged by her hair by Diddy in a hotel hallway. And I say by Diddy because it's something he apologized for doing online, went on social media after this leaked and said how sorry he was and ashamed he was. Prosecutors have now informed the court that from now on, Cassie Ventura is her name. She is no longer a number. They also just brought 2 additional counts against Diddy, 1 each of sex trafficking and transportation to engage in prostitution. So that brings the total number of charges he's facing to 5. We reached out to Team Diddy today, and we got back the following statement, but nobody would come on the air with us. Quote, these are not new allegations or new accusers. These are the same individuals, former long-term girlfriends who were involved in consensual relationships. This was their private sex life, defined by consent, not coercion, end quote. I'm joined once again by defense attorney and former prosecutor Mark Eiglarsh. I said he'd be back, and here he is. And I'm going to put that law degree to work because the internet is on fire, Mark. Everybody's saying Cassie can't testify because she signed a non-disclosure agreement in the settlement with Diddy. So take it away.
Well, when prosecutors subpoena you and require you to testify, you're going to testify. That's different. Non-disclosure agreement. All right, you can't go and tell the public what happened and get paid for your story. So she's coming out and saying who she is because she's sympathetic. Who doesn't look at that video and say, oh my goodness, who is that poor victim who he's beating? So I don't know that it shows courage. I think that she's getting the publicity that goes along with being a true victim of a very violent offense.
Well, that's actually a really good point. I want to pull on that string a little more. You do not have to come forward with your name. She had every right to come into this trial and remain victim number 1. Everybody's made their assumptions online, but she didn't have to. Is there something to that that might make Diddy's team shake in their boots? Does it lend any more strength to the prosecutor's case? Is it something the prosecutors would have asked her to do?
No, 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 no to all those questions. Whether she's Rihanna or whether she's Jane Doe, I don't think matters. I think that when jurors are there focused on the facts of the case, they're going to determine whether the evidence meets the elements of the crime, period. I don't think who she is really matters.
Well, I'll tell you what. It is unquestionable that her civil lawsuit against P. Diddy opened the floodgates when it was settled. Sure. All of a sudden, there were so many who came forward, and prosecutors read all of their complaints and almost formulated their criminal complaint based on the civil complaints. Do you think that Cassie coming out publicly and saying, I am not a number, I am a name, might actually open the gates for others to do the same in this trial and come out publicly with their names too?
Yes, it takes a lot of courage for unnamed people to come forward and take on someone as powerful as Diddy, who can afford the best doggone lawyers to vigorously and zealously cross-examine them. It takes extraordinary courage. But when someone comes forward and they're believed and the public actually rallies around them, others say, you know what, that could be my experience. I'm going to step forward.
I am so curious because I could not believe the tsunami that she created just by coming forward as the first. And here we are in a criminal courtroom in just like a little over a month. Mark Aguilar, thank you for this. Really appreciate it. I'm going to ask you again. You got to come back. You'll do that, right?
All right, we'll do.
Okay, thank you, sir. All right, before we move on, I do have news of a very big hire in the case against Brian Koberger in Idaho. The former top federal prosecutor in the state of Idaho has just joined the team that wants to send Koberger to death row for those four student murders in that state. His name is Josh Hurwit, and he left his post as U.S. attorney less than 2 months ago. But his law career began a quarter of a century ago as a prosecution intern in, of all places, Latah County. And you will know that that is exactly where the quadruple murders occurred. Still ahead tonight, a native tribe that's been isolated from the rest of the world for thousands of years and are willing to kill any outsider who visits. But somehow the latest visitor escaped their typical bows and arrows. So why is that visitor now in jail? And what was he planning to do with the can of Diet Coke? Full story next. A social media influencer tries to connect with a tribe of people isolated from humanity for thousands of years. What could go wrong? How about everything? Which is no doubt what lured Mihailo Polykov, a 24-year-old YouTuber from Arizona, to travel to North Sentinel Island. That is a 23-square-mile island in the Bay of Bengal, far off the east coast of India. Polykov apparently decided to roll up to this isolated tribe, having first decided that his original destination wasn't adventurous enough for his YouTube channel, the Taliban in Afghanistan. So he scrapped those plans. By way of introduction, the Sentinelese people are known to be the most isolated group on Earth. They are also very dangerous. It's a 150-member tribe known for near-total self-sufficiency and known for attacking trespassers. In 2006, they killed two fishermen whose boat had washed ashore. In 2018, a young American missionary was shot dead with bows and arrows and buried on the beach. His body has never been recovered. None of this dissuaded Polykov, who on March 29th paddled ashore armed with only a whistle, a pair of binoculars, and presumably a camera. He scouted the island for any sign of a welcoming party, and seeing none, he used his whistle to try to scare up some intention, but still got nothing. And for whatever reason, the Sentinelese did one thing that no YouTuber can stand. They stayed hidden. After about an hour of being the least popular man on an almost deserted island, Polykov called it quits, shooting a quick video for his channel before leaving gifts for the islanders, a couple of coconuts and a can of Diet Coke. On his way out, he was spotted by some local fishermen, and soon after that, he was arrested because it is a crime punishable by 5 years in prison for outsiders to get within 3 miles of North Sentinel Island. And there is a good reason for that. A group called Survival International, which advocates for indigenous people, said this, and I will quote them. "It beggars belief that someone could be that reckless and idiotic. This person's actions not only endangered his own life, they put the lives of the entire Sentinelese tribe at risk. It's very well known by now that uncontacted peoples have no immunity to common outside diseases like flu or measles, which could completely wipe them out." Polykov remains in an Indian jail and is due back in court next week. Hope all of those views were worth it. Coming up next, a story that is to die for. Do you remember the 1990s blockbuster where Nicole Kidman played a woman having an affair with a student and then convinced that student to kill her husband?
To be a star,
you gotta be able to do things that ordinary people wouldn't do.
Was the opportunity
she would kill for.
Okay. That movie was actually based on a true story, and it looks like another true story just like it is playing out in Kentucky. Talk about true crime. Grab your popcorn. It's next.
Thanks for listening to News Nation on the Go. I'm Chris Cuomo. This is America's fastest growing cable news network, delivering fact-based, unbiased news from all sides.
And now to a story that is to die for. A Kentucky teacher who mostly taught at a juvenile detention center has ended up in detention herself. And her story tracks like the plot of the 1990s blockbuster movie To Die For. If you remember, in that film, Nicole Kidman played a woman having an affair with a student who convinced that student to kill her husband. The movie was actually based on a real-life case in New Hampshire back in 1992. A woman named Pamela Smart was a teacher found guilty of getting her student lover to kill her husband. She was just 23 years old when she was sentenced to life with no parole. But today she's 57, and she might have some great advice for that teacher in Kentucky. Until recently, Elena Barden was a teacher at a juvenile detention center there, but now she's locked up in her own detention center, accused of sexually abusing one of the juvenile inmates and asking him to kill her husband. The husband is okay, thank God, because police intervened before anyone got killed, but investigators say they've got letters and pictures that prove Elena was cooking up a scheme. If things look bleak for Elena, they should. Just a couple of years ago, Pamela Smart petitioned to have her life sentence reduced after serving 3 decades in prison, but the judge said no.